Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between independent filmmakers and songwriters, where we host a weekly conversation with award-winning filmmakers, marquee musicians, and leading music industry professionals. Meet industry experts and top-level songwriters as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities to our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider the music submitted by you, our audience. Hosted by music supervisor and former Sony Epic executive, Jason P. Rothberg, along with your co-host and the godmother of indie films, Rose Ganguza. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment and subscribe to the Sync podcast on Apple and across all platforms.
Yo, can someone stop Twiggy? It's just touch me in all the wrong places.
Twiggy, leave Milfredo alone.
I love you, Milfredo.
It's time now for a joke from Jackie Martling.
Two flies land on a piece of manure. The first fly lifts his leg and... Second fly says, come on, man. I'm trying to eat.
Welcome to the Sync Report.
Thank you, Willow. And yes, this is the Sync Report. Kicking things off with a bit of humor with our own Jackie Martling. And I'm not sure what is going on between Milfredo and Twiggy. But I do know one thing. It's going to be a great show.
We are welcoming back Ray Lee, filmmaker Ray Lee. They've confirmed the songs that they've picked. So that's great.
So grab a drink. Let's have a conversation about music and sync. Oh,
Paula, Willow, who's in the hot seat tonight?
Rob Bozas.
Our guest, Rob Bozas, who has been running Real World Publishing, the WOMAD archive, and is partners with Peter Gabriel. He's worked with many iconic acts, including Boy George, Natalie Cole, Robert Plant, Alton Edwards, and he's placed hundreds of syncs in films as well, including Shrek 2, Gangs of New York, The Bourne Identity, Children of Men, The Constant Gardener, which is actually a soundtrack I did the marketing on, Eat, Pray, Love, Wall Street, Dead Man Walking, Snowden, Babe, Pig in the City,
oh my God,
Eddie the Eagle, and my kid's favorite, Wall-E.
Yes, classics. Oh, brilliant. Oh my God, so exciting. All right, guys, let's get this conversation started.
You know, you're from South Africa during a time of apartheid. Your father is involved in politics, if I'm not mistaken. So it's something that you're living and breathing, you know, and then obviously as you're getting into music and DJing, you're merging the, so how, you know, being a young person, before you even started getting into music, what was life like growing up in South Africa?
Wow, Jason, how long you got? 2 weeks?
Give it to us.
South Africa is very, very interesting. Certainly for me, it was the most exciting possible way to grow up. It was a little bit weird for me. I finished school quite young. I was 17 when I finished school and went to university. And that was 1976. And I remember going into university and hearing the campus radio station. And I listened to what they were playing. And I thought, what is this crap these people are playing? And I couldn't work out what was going on. Eventually, I went and saw them. And I realized it was run by most of the people from the electronic engineering faculty. Okay. And, well, they were lovely people. And technically, they were brilliant. But they'd worked out a system where they could basically make random playlists with about, I think they had six quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape decks that would trigger one song, then the next song, then the next song randomly. So depended where you started them, you'd get a random, but that's how they provided music. Mm. And I thought, nah, this isn't radio. So I went and saw the student's representative council and told them that the radio station was rubbish. Me being a cocky 17-year-old told them that I thought I could do a much better job. And much to my surprise, they asked me to explain what I do. And I gave them a kind of idea about how I'd run playlists and make sure everything was live, because it's when people are running on fear that you get really good radio, rather than everything canned and come out afterwards. So to my surprise, they all came back and said, yeah, you've got the job. You're now president of the radio station.
Incredible. At 17, your first year in college.
Yeah. And so I started kind of recruiting DJs and getting live radio going. And my university was a quite a radical university. There were four universities in South Africa that the constitution of the university was written into the constitution of the country. And what was interesting was they said all four universities had complete and utter academic freedom, which meant that on my university, Cape Town University, Wits University in Johannesburg, and the University of the Orange Free State, basically what happened on that campus was up to the chancellor of the university. And certainly in Cape Town, Wits, and the University of Natal Durban, there was no apartheid on campus.
So I'm curious, Rob, were you having to turn in your playlist before you could play the music? You needed permission?
No. That didn't happen. That's a whole nother. No, but what was interesting was that there were black students in the same classes and using the restaurants and using the same toilets, which didn't happen anywhere else in South Africa.
Oh, of course not.
Absolutely.
I wonder how that policy, how was the university able to see everybody as equals? Where outside the walls, it was going crazy.
Well, the university offered a few odd courses. Like there was a course that was done that was Roman history from a Zulu perspective.
Oh, wow.
Which meant that if you were a black guy, there was no university in the country that offered Roman history from a Latin, from an African perspective, but my university. So if you wanted to do that course as part of your degree, you could qualify to go to the university.
Incredible.
I mean, it was as bizarre as that. Yeah, so we had black students, we had Indian students, we had mixed race students. And of course, I recruited them all into the radio station. But in amongst the students, there were also spies, police spies, the famous, it's kind of the South African version of the Stasi, was called BOS, the Bureau of State Security. So they were watching what everybody was doing. And I just got the radio station going sort of properly by about the end of May 1976. And on the 16th of June, 1976, Soweto exploded with the Soweto riots. And the whole country was a tinderbox. So we, being a radical university and a radical radio station on a radical university, the security police were all over us and watching what we were playing and what we were doing.
So what kind of songs are you playing at this time?
Are they
protest songs? Are you just like thinking about the music itself?
Well, I had started a completely different program, because the engineers, lovely for what they were sort of playing a little bit of prog rock and a lot of disco. And when I took over in 1976, I started playing a lot of two-tone music, a lot of reggae, and quite a lot of African music, South African music itself. So we started playing people like Sipho Hotsticks Mabuse. Well, interestingly enough, Johnny Clegg and Sipho Mthunu. When they first turned up at our university to play, you know, it was an acoustic, two acoustic guitars and a stomp box.
Incredible.
But so what we also did as a radio station was we promoted a lot of concerts and a lot of events. So we were slowly taking an old audience to a new audience, playing a lot, slowly more political and more radical stuff, you know, like the Beats, Stand Down Margaret, Stand Down Please, kind of those kind of things. Slowly introducing stuff that made people think. And the whole two-tone movement, like the Selector, the Specials, you know, all that kind of stuff that was actually challenging racism in the UK and a little bit of hip hop. But yeah, at that time, it's interesting. Rapper's Delight and stuff like that had just started coming out. And for me, it was really weird. I didn't realize that many years later, I would meet a lot of the people who worked on Rapper's Delight and part of the Sugar Hill Gang, like E.T. Thorngren and Skip McDonald and people like that. But what we did on the radio station is we did that a lot, you know, and we also used to provide technical support for a lot of political meetings. So, yeah, the university, you know, we'd have meetings, we'd put on an academic freedom concert. We put on the concert, what would happen is the police would come in, tear gas the crowd, and there'd be dogs and people would get arrested. And you got to remember that they had what they called detention without trial. So there was, nobody had to give you a reason to arrest you. They could just grab you and take you off the street and just say, yes, you've been detained.
So is this about the time that you actually, that you met with Biko? I mean, you're organizing obviously events that are going against the norm in South Africa. You must have been noticed by these human rights activists and political leaders. How did you go from the radio station into actually interacting with these prolific leaders?
Well, I mean, it's quite interesting. Is, you know, I had quite a lot of black guys DJing on my radio station. Fortunately for me, when I grew up speaking Zulu, so I had one advantage, which quite a lot of white people don't have, is that my Zulu is pretty good. So I made a lot of buddies. But one of the things that happened is that in January 1977, we had Freshers Week, because the university starts January to December, the academic year. It doesn't start in September like the academic year in the UK. So we had Freshers Week in January, and part of that is we had a meeting where a lot of speakers turned up to the meetings. And in this particular meeting, we had Mandela's daughter, Zinzi Mandela, when Mandela was still in prison. We had a really interesting guy that I did shared a lot of classes with, Pat Molefe, who was also very covertly connected with the ANC. And then Steve Biko was also invited to come and speak and address the audience. So Steve, yeah, he turned up at the university in 1977, January, to speak to all of us. So that was where I was very fortunate and, you know, got the opportunity to meet Steve. Now, I think that's how this discussion started, was I was saying to you, I always laugh because whenever I hear Peter Gabriel playing Biko and I'm in a crowd, you know, in an arena or somewhere like that, I look around and I think, I bet I'm the only guy in this whole audience who actually met Steve.
I'm sure. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know if you're comfortable, but could you tell that story that you shared with me? Do you feel comfortable sharing the conversation that you had with him? I just find the perspective so poignant.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm very comfortable with it. I don't know whether everybody will be comfortable with it, but all I can say is, let me finish before you go, oh my God, oh my God. I do remember sitting in a room and we were talking about challenging the apartheid regime. And people were talking about black rights, you know, and black liberation. And it's interesting, there's a segue here, because the segue is also looking at the BLM movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, and how so many people have tried to sort of take the power away from the black rights BLM movement. But what, you know, and I think people sort of have misunderstood that. What I understand the BLM movement to be all about is that a lot of black people are saying, hey, I also need rights. I can see white people have got rights. I can see a lot of privileged people having rights, and you're ignoring my rights. So that's how I understand the BLM movement. Now, to wind back to Steve Biko, they were talking about black liberation. We were all sitting around a table talking and having coffee and stuff before everyone goes on stage. And some of the white guys were saying, yeah, you know, black rights are important. And I went, well, I'm sorry, guys, I disagree with you. I don't give a toss about black people's rights. I'm not going to fight for black people's rights at all. I'm not interested.
Controversial. I can only imagine the response from everybody in that room must have been horrified.
Well, yeah, the room went very quiet. And Bika said to me, why? So I said, because I'm not black, I'm white. I'm happy to fight for equal rights, but I'll come over as a bit disingenuous fighting for black people's rights. Fighting for equal rights, I'll definitely support anything you do, but your voice supports black rights, and I understand why. And I'm fighting for everybody to have equal rights, and I'm fighting definitely not for the preservation of only white rights. I don't have to fight for white rights. Whites have already got rights. Steve turned around and said, this guy gets it.
And I mean, it's just something that we all need to kind of absorb. I mean, you know, 40 years later, you know, we're still dealing with these similar topics. And until we can all look at each other the same and, you know, and want the same for each other, the playing field is always going to be crooked. So, I mean, amazing that young Rob Bozzas tapped into that and, you know, had the strength to actually stand up and be a leader like that. I'm so moved by this man's strength and ability to see so clearly in such confusion. Coming from these roots, and, you know, we're not going to have time to talk about, you know, the boat cruise tours and the DJing and the promotion of shows and, you know, the artists that you actually started producing in South Africa. You were gathering all these skills and you moved to England. Can you tell me about that transition?
Yeah, I'd sort of produced a few records in South Africa, started from being a running the radio station, and people would bring in stuff and you'd say, look, your song's great, but the production's rubbish. And a guy said to me, well, if you're so clever, why don't you come and produce my record? I've got a record deal.
Uh-oh, a challenge. So
that's how I ended up producing the first record I ever worked on. That was a guy called Dan Kapuya, who was doing kind of Afro reggae. And what's really interesting is I then left South Africa and traveled around Europe for almost a year, just bought a van and drove around Europe, and then got back to the UK and realized I had $300 and a van and I needed to eat, and $300 in England's not going to last a long time. So I had to get a job. And weirdly enough, I got a job with my wife at the time and I working in a castle, cooking and managing a building project. Incredible. So that's the job we did. And yeah, I was sometimes working as a builder, sometimes sorting out the garden, directing, making sure the builders got paid. And on the weekends, people would turn up in Ferraris and helicopters, and then we'd have to prepare meals for about between 15 and 20 people.
The ultimate Airbnb.
Yeah, it was kind of, yeah, it was pretty classy. I mean, it was, you know, crystal chandeliers and the whole trip and you know, Rolls Royces, Bentleys, Ferraris, and helicopters.
Which must have been crazy for, you know, I mean, I can't imagine much of that was in South Africa. So what a transition.
Yeah, pretty much. I was having to learn how to run an Argus stove, how to keep fires burning, yeah, all of that kind of stuff. But to cut a long story short, what happened is one day a whole bunch of people, yeah, it's interesting, one of the guys who was there was James Guthrie, who was I think he produced Wish You Were Here. Mm. A whole lot of people went for a walk, and they went off for a walk through the beautiful hills, the Mendip Hills, which are really beautiful. And I got a phone call and they said, oh, there are about 8 or 9 of us. We holed up in a pub. It was tipping down with rain. And they said, we've been waiting for the rain to abate, and it's just not doing it. And we can't drink anymore. can you come and pick us up in your combi van and, you know, take us back to the castle? So I went, yeah, okay, fine. So long as you don't mind sitting in the back, I'm fine with that. So I went down, took the van down, piled everybody in the back, and we started driving back. Now, this is what I'm saying to people about is you never know where luck strikes. So we piled everybody in, and two people jumped in the side seat in the front of the combi, and off we were going, it was still tipping with rain, and the wipers were going cuck, 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 cuck. And this woman pushed the cassette and the cassette player, yeah, and the music started playing. And she went, I mean, we're talking about, this is 1986.
Okay.
And she was going, hey, wow, this is really cool music. What is this? And, you know, without thinking, I said, oh, it's a record I produced when I was in South Africa. And she said, what, you produced a record? And I went, yeah, a few. She said, I've got a recording studio. Why don't you come work for me?
Oh, my God, incredible.
That is how it worked.
And what studio was this, Rob?
That's a studio in London called Swan Yard Recording Studios.
Is this where you began? Were you engineering at this point, or were you producing bands?
Well, when I first turned up there, I was what you do when you start in a studio and nobody knows what you can or can't do. I was making tea. I was lining up tape machines, making sure the sessions got done on time. Yeah, renting the gear in, making sure the bands were comfortable, doing recalls afterwards, making sure everything was, you know, all the sessions were sorted. Yeah, that was working hard. It was, you know, 16, 18, sometimes 20-hour days.
Yeah.
But when you're an immigrant and you're new in a country and you've got to prove your worth, I'm not arrogant enough to think I could say to everybody, hey, I'm better than all of you. I thought, you know what, put your head down and work. And if you're good enough, it'll come through.
How long were you doing all those support duties until you actually got turned loose on the board?
Well, that's what's interesting, because what happens is that you get all sorts of people booking into even fancy recording studios. And it's like a hotel. Anybody can book a room. Sometimes people will turn up with a producer. Sometimes they turn up with people who don't know what they're doing, and you take over and you start helping people. You know, I think certainly for the first few months, what would start happening is you'd get some guy who'd worked on a very small mixing desk before and sort of had an idea of the principles. But when he's suddenly confronted with an automated 48-channel SSL mixing desk with two 24-track tape machines synchronized together, it's kind of a little bit overwhelming. Mm. And the guy can't concentrate on getting everything else organized because he's still trying to work out how to drive the damn thing, the board. So you start helping people. And one of the first people like that I helped was a guy called Zio, who used to be the Fairlight program and player for Parliament and Funkadelic. And Zio was an interesting guy. I mean, he was super talented and amazing with a Fairlight. He could make stuff happen on a Fairlight that still amazes me today. But he didn't know his way around an SSL. So I started helping him. We worked on some really cool projects. So that kind of stuff all happened. And then slowly what happened is we had a room at the back, which was a mix studio. So I started working on a lot of mix sessions and did a lot of work with an American record producer called Michael Baker. A lot of the pop projects he was working on. And that was really good because later on he started working with a band called Wet, Wet, Wet. It got to the point where they were running behind time a little bit and they needed kind of to speed up the sessions. So they needed guitars being recorded. So while they were recording in Studio One, Michael said to me, you know, can you go and record the guitars in Studio Two? So started recording guitars, doing stuff like that. Then started working with a lot of different people and helping on mixes as well, particularly where people were mixing both recording to tape, but MIDI. So people were using a lot of MIDI and sequencing. So they were using Logic and Cubase to sequence up a whole lot of MIDI gear. And I got pretty good at sorting out all those problems and getting those all to work. So I worked on a lot of different mixes, which was how the Natalie Cole thing happened. That was just a remixing kind of thing with someone and nothing was working. So I ended up working on the session and getting all the gear working, sequencing up everything. Yeah, and just being part of that mix team. I think, you know, a very similar thing was with Danny Wilson's Mary's Prayer. Stephen Haig was mixing that. And again, a lot of the equipment wasn't working brilliantly. And I got called in to do that and get all that happening and just sat in with Stephen Haig on that session. You know, I think the thing is when you're working with a really good producer who knows his way around the board anyway, it's about being almost invisible, just making sure that by the time he thinks of doing something, you've already done it. And he goes, oh, okay, we've got that work. Oh, you've already got a delay for that. Oh, that's a really nice reverb you've chosen. You know, that kind of thing.
I mean, it's such an important lesson for the, you know, the up and coming musicians and artists in the room is really, you know, what you've done is made yourself irreplaceable. You know, you know the gear, you know what the producers are looking for. You became friendly with the musicians. You know, you became, you know, a permanent fixture in that studio. Absolutely amazing, Rob.
Yeah, I think it was very, very interesting because at that time, like now, if you want to qualify as an engineer, there are a lot of university courses. When I did that, there weren't any university courses. It was in at the deep end. You can either do it or you can't. And none of those record producers, you know, whether you talk about, you know, Robin Millar, whether you talk about Stephen Hay, whether you talk about, oh, there's just so many, Russ Ballard, people like that, all those people. If you can't do it, you're out of that session. Nobody wants to carry anybody.
No, not at that level.
Yeah, they just don't want to carry anybody. So you've got to make sure everything's just happening and it stays happening.
So is this the same time period that you actually got a chance to work with Alton Edwards and Robert Plant?
Yeah, well, Alton is interesting. He spent a lot of time in and out of the studio, and I was very lucky because Alton's actually from Zimbabwe and we got on really, really well. So often, even in downtime, Alton would come in and do a lot of songwriting. We'd spend time in the studio and just playing with ideas and seeing what we could come up with. So that was, for me, a wonderful opportunity to learn how to get a little bit clever with the board, not just do it, but get a little bit clever every now and again. So Alton, you know, I've got a lot to thank Alton for. He helped me a lot there. Yeah, the Robert Plant session, that was really funny because I was kind of still the new boy at the studio. There were other engineers at the studio as well. A session got booked in. The session was called To Hell With Jazz. Right. And so, you know, I got given the tapes and they'd been recording at another studio somewhere and laid down some stuff. And they said, oh yeah, the producer will be turning up, you know, at 2 o'clock. So, you know, get the room ready. And the guys just said to me, To Hell With Jazz, you can have that session. So I went like, yeah, okay, fine. So I put the tapes up and I took out the track sheets and started kind of getting a bit of a balance up so that at least when they turned up, they could press play and we'd be almost ready to go. I didn't know who the producer was and I didn't know what he was expecting. So I pushed all the faders up, had a look, got a drum balance, brought the bass in, brought some keyboards in, brought some guitars in. There were no vocals on it at all. And I thought, wowski, this is not jazz. And it's so unbelievably beautifully recorded. And the song construction is just extraordinary. All of the songs, didn't matter what song I brought up on the board, pushed up the faders basically in a straight line that already sounded pretty good. So, you know, worked out a few songs and I knew what song we were starting on. We were starting on a song called Billy's Revenge. And so you know, I got the tempos, I got some delays set up and worked out some reverbs and stuff and just thought, okay, well, let's wait for the producer to turn up and see what he wants. At 2 o'clock, this guy walked in the room and went, oh, that's not sounding too bad at all. Oh, and he made a few suggestions. So yeah, that's fine. And that turned out to be a producer called Tim Palmer. So I thought, yeah, okay, this is cool. And then he said to me, yeah, can you line up a whole lot of microphones? We want to start experimenting with some microphones because Robert's going to be turning up at about 4 o'clock. So, yeah, I went and lined up a whole lot of microphones. I had no idea who Robert was.
Oh, God.
Yeah, well, come 4 o'clock, who turned up but Mr. Plant himself? And, you know, I think all I can remember saying to myself is, don't cock up, make sure you get it right.
Unbelievable. And again, here, Rob, I mean, you're just working with so many different sounds and styles. I mean, forget the fact that they're all big names, but it seems like you're really coming up as a, you know, an engineering, maybe could have gone into producing further. But I think at this point, you kind of transition into publishing. Is that, you know?
Yeah, well, in a big way, I thank Tim Palmer so much for that, because what I did realize was the technical side of doing that kind of stuff and the listening side is not that difficult to do. But I realized I'm just not as good a musician in terms of my musical theory and understanding harmony, composition, and just how to cleverly musically manipulate something from a compositional perspective. I was just not good enough. I knew I'd have to go back, go to music school and go and learn if I wanted to be
producer.
A really good producer, you know, an amazing engineer producer. So when the opportunity to move into publishing came up, I thought, well, I spent quite a few years at law school. Hold on. Music, understanding composition, understanding how these songs are all put together, and doing the legal side and the copyright side. It was a marriage made in heaven. I just thought, yeah, this is what I want to do. So I moved into publishing.
Was Soul to Soul the first act that you actually started working with as a publisher?
I mean, that's interesting. A guy called Steve Proctor, who we were doing some dance music with, he started managing Rose Windross. So Rose had written Fair Play, and we had to sort out a deal with Jazzy B to make sure that Rose got a fair share of that song. So we had to do that, and one of the things was fighting with Virgin Records, who Soul to Soul came out on. Well, everybody puts a million lawyers between you and them. You know, hey, it's not me, it's what the lawyers say kind of thing. But eventually we sorted out a deal and then got the royalties. And then I learned about collecting the royalties and how to make sure you get the paperwork lined up when you have got people who will do whatever they can to make things difficult while they're smiling at you. And that's kind of what happened quite a lot. We did get a deal for Rose.
And, it's so perfect. You know, it's this guy from South Africa banging the table and negotiating now. I mean, you're kind of just made for this, I think.
Yeah, we signed Working Week, must have been in 1988 or 1989. Yeah, and we put out a record at that time called Fire from the Mountain, and that did pretty well, and then followed up with a second album called Black and Gold. Yeah, and on that, we got quite a few syncs. The band was touring, playing the stuff all over Europe. So it was a good, effective touring band, principally led by two people, a guy called Simon Emerson and Larry Sabins, who were the two kind of driving forces behind Working Week. But Simon Emerson then went on to form the Afrocult Sound System, and then he went on to form the Imagined Village and did a lot of work with Baba Mal and Manu Dibango.
It was almost like you were being groomed to move into Real World and WOMAD. How did that begin? How did you, you know, first get that introduction? Was it to Peter Gabriel? Was it somebody within the structure? How did you move into Real World?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. My lesson to everybody is get your head down and graft. And I'm going to again segue a little bit here. Is I have a friend of mine who's a film director, and he worked with an extraordinary film director when he was about 24 years old. And he was watching this guy work, and my friend Graham was just looking at this guy working and thinking, I've got to learn so much from this guy. He is so clever. And when the project finished, Graham drove the guy to the airport, and as he was saying goodbye to him, he said to him, can I ask you something? So the guy went, yeah, sure, Graham, what is it? Graham said, well, how do I set myself on a course to be as good as you are? Mm. And the guy looked at Graham and said, be good, I'll see you. And he left. And Graham thought, you arrogant whatever. And Graham says, 25 years later on, somebody once said to him, I've been watching you working. How do I get as good as you? And Graham's response was, be good. So the bottom line here I'm saying to everybody is, it doesn't matter what you do, just be good.
So
you asked me how I got to Real World. When I was working for Swan Yard, we had a really cool band called Galliano. If you think of, they kind of were the forerunner to the Black Eyed Peas, except it was two white black English guys and two Irish English guys. So this was this wonderful mixture of kind of Jamaican roots and Irish roots, and really cool, sarcastic, pun-laden, metaphorical rapping to really cool tunes, and they could really drop it on the beat really well. So, you know, they brought out three albums, and every album sold kind of 300,000-400,000 albums, so they didn't do badly. Then Swanyard, sadly, had made films in Hollywood, and for some reasons, something went wrong with the films. They ran out of money. The company started going bankrupt. And I'd taken over by that time. I was the managing director of the publishing company. And Galliano's lawyers approached me and said that because my previous boss had left, they were out of their contract. So I looked at the contract and thought, well, hold on a second. They signed to a company. They didn't sign to a man. There was no key man clause in there at all. So I went back to the lawyers and went, sorry, the company's still working. We're still doing music publishing. They're not out of the contract. We got into a prolonged war. What was difficult was that because Swanyard at the time was going into receivership, Swanyard's lawyers would not help me at all. Mm. So basically, I had to defend our position against some very high-profile English legal firm. But we had a number of little battles, but somehow, I mean, I just stuck to the contract and made sure I read it carefully, and sure enough, I was winning them. We had one wonderful scene in the boardroom at this legal firm, and they thought they'd caught me out, but when I showed them that whoever had done the analysis of all the royalties had forgotten about one crucial element, and once we added this crucial element in, my figures were spot on. So everybody was very upset. I left that meeting feeling good with myself. And after that, nothing happened. Everything went quiet, and then the lawyers phoned me again. And I couldn't work out why they were phoning me, so I wouldn't take the calls. And after about the fifth phone call, finally, it was one of those phone calls where the PA or the person on the receptionist puts a call through to you without announcing who it is. And I spoke to this lawyer, and he said to me, are you interested in a job? I went, not really. You know, I like fighting with you. But I said, you know, I'm not so stupid as I won't listen to a proposal if you've got one. So we had a meeting, and we discussed various things. He never, ever told me who the meeting was with. I think that happened in about January, and in about March. Yeah, it was March or the beginning of April. I eventually went and had a meeting with the client. I still didn't know who the client was. And that's when I met this fabulously well-mannered, but really cool and relaxed gentleman who the first thing he did was offered me a cup of tea, made me a cup of tea. And we sat down and started talking music. And yeah, we started at the time his house was being built. So there were all builders in the house. So he borrowed a ghetto blaster from covered in paint from the builders. And we put a few cassettes in and talked about them. And that's kind of how it happened.
So who is this English gentleman who's offering tea and knowledgeable about music?
Well, that was Mr. Gabriel.
Incredible. Amazing.
In the various meetings that I'd had before that and things had been mentioned, I'd already worked out what was going on.
This meeting goes incredibly well. You're welcomed into the family. And now all of a sudden you've earned the position in being responsible for Mr. Gabriel's personal archive, the real world catalog, the WOMAD catalog. How are you absorbing all of this music? Obviously, you know, your roots from South Africa and being a DJ, you're absorbing so much music from so many different genres and locations. So I can see how you're primed up, but I mean, it must have been overwhelming to step into those positions.
Well, again, you know, I think it'll be the same for anybody. If you went to work for Madonna, or if you went to work for Tom Jones now, or Ed Sheeran, once you get in, you discover there is already a team there. There are lawyers, there are accountants, there are tax advisors, there are technical specialists, there are all sorts of people. All these people have got teams around them and got very good PAs. So it's not like you're stepping into a vacuum. It's more about stepping in, and I don't know what anybody else would do, but what I elected to actually not do anything, but to learn, because what I wanted to make sure was that they would know that I was a safe pair of hands, that they weren't employing somebody who was being cavalier, didn't understand the principles and how to work with the artists, with the composers. So yeah, try to be a safe pair of hands.
So at this point, you're working with Joseph Arthur, and I mean, how did you meet Sean O'Riordan, for example?
With Sean O'Riordan, it was very different. But it's a link through Working Week, because Working Week connected me with Simon Emerson. Simon Emerson then had formed the Afrocult Sound System, and they were the first band that I signed to Real World Works in 1996. So I signed them to Real World's publishing operation in 1996. But that got a little bit complicated because Simon had attended a Real World Recording Week. And basically, he'd prepared a lot of backing tracks, had a room with some recording equipment, and he put a sign on the door that said, if you're African or Irish, come in here. And people who attended that room, there was Musa Sissoko, there was Mfali Kuyati, there was a guy called Demba Barry, and one of the singers was a guy called Iolo Leonard, who's a fabulous Sean Nose singer. Sean Nose is old-style Irish singing. And on the first Afrocults album, so that's volume one, the Iolo sings a lot of the Irish songs. He also had a song on that record called Even Cronin. And when he sang Even Cronin, he said, oh, that's interesting, because when I was 10 years old, I did a version of Even Cronin with Paddo O'Riordan. So he then played us the 10-year-old recording with him and Paddo, and that was quite interesting. So we then, because he kept the same arrangement for the Afrocults version, so we asked Paddo. Paddo had a share of the publishing. So I got hold of Paddo and did a publishing deal with Paddo. And then we put the Afrocults record out. And the one thing that really surprised Paddo was how accurate our accounting was and how regular our accounting was. And amazingly, it was normally accompanied with a check. And Paddo, that really impressed Paddo.
And Paddo is Sean's son, correct?
Correct.
Just shocking that these are the things that they're happy with, being accounted to and receiving royalties. You know, it's you would think that this is something that every artist should naturally get, but it's not the story. You know, if you don't get in bed with somebody you can actually trust, these reports become a bit dodgy, I guess.
Well, I think a lot of people start for a while used to account on spreadsheets, and spreadsheets are fine until you've got 30 or 40 artists and money coming from all over the planet. It starts to get very, very difficult to stay on top of things. And Real World, fortunately, had invested in the same accounting software that I had used at Swan Yard. So it was a very good system, a very clear reporting. And so it really allows you, when you're running a business, to stay on top of it, to work out how much money you've got in, what your publisher retained share is, and what the royalties payable out are. And it shows when you last paid them and what the next payments due are. It's, so, yeah, that's some music publishing software at the time called Music Maestro. And it just worked brilliantly. So that won us quite a few clients. But I started looking after Paddo and then publishing a lot of his other works. And once Paddo saw that a lot of royalties were coming in, because as music publishers, you chase things down. And a lot of his records had come out in America, and people weren't filing their mechanicals. So once we chased them down, we followed up and we got the money and we drew it in. Paddo was really impressed and said, right, now I've watched you for three royalty statements. I'd like you to now collect for Sean as well. So then we started collecting for Sean.
And just so everyone really understands, I mean, Sean O'Riordan is a king, is a god, you know, here in Ireland. The respect that the Irish have for this poet, this brilliant musician. In fact, I was with Donovan recently, who just was going on and on and on about him. So, I mean, what an incredible notch on your wall there to be representing that family. At this time, Rob, I mean, is this about 1996? Is this when you get to Hollywood and now you're kind of stepping into the sync world?
Yeah, well, what was interesting, although I was looking after Mr. Gabriel's catalogue, I had the whole WOMAD music catalog. And we had fantastic artists like Remy Ongala, Jeffrey Oryema, Ayub Agada, Yu Srinivas, and the great Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. And we weren't seeing any sync revenue at all. The only sync revenue we'd seen had been from Peter working on the Passion movie, where we earned pretty good money for a lot of the other artists that Peter worked with. And then we did a bit of work. Just as I joined Real World, they'd just done some work on Natural Born Killers. Mm-hmm. And Remy Ongala had some tracks in there. And there was a Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan track that he did with Peter called Taboo in that film. So those tracks earned pretty good money. So I looked at that and thought, you know what? Time to get yourself over to Los Angeles. But the one thing I thought is, if I tell anybody I work for Peter Gabriel, that's all they're going to want to talk about. So I didn't tell anybody I work for Peter Gabriel, and I sent out a lot of faxes. I tried to find out the names and contact details of as many music supervisors as I could, and faxed a lot of people, and eventually ended up with a bunch of meetings. And on the back of that, I got on an aeroplane. I didn't even know how big Los Angeles was.
This is your first time. I didn't realize that was your first trip to LA. Oh, my goodness.
It's interesting with a few people when I came back and when I'd end my meeting, some people, you know, I'd said to them, well, oh, yeah, also look after Peter Gabriel. If you're interested in any of his music, this is what I can do for you. Yeah, that did turn out to be quite interesting because at that time I did meet Mike Knobloch, is now president of Universal Music Publishing, Film Music Publishing. And, you know, he's always been so gracious and so lovely. Yeah, that was a wonderful person to meet. Yeah, I met up with people like Robert Kraft, met Dawn Soler at the time, who's now at CBS or one of those. Yeah, so just I met loads of people. Mary Ramos, who does a lot of Tarantino's work. Bud Carr. Yeah, just I was
obviously you met all the right people. Like Paula was saying, you know, Shrek 2 and Gangs of New York, Born Identity, Children of Men, Eat, Pray, Love, Wall Street. The list, Deadpool 2. I mean, it just goes and goes and goes for miles. I mean, what a legacy! And to be part of all of these, you must have had a massive learning curve when it comes to syncs and how these deals, which is, I know, an interest for our audience. Can you maybe just tell us one of the hundreds of stories that you must have regarding these deals? You know, something that, you know, maybe, you know, you negotiated something that you were very proud of or some deal points that maybe some of our songwriters should be thinking about when they're negotiating their sync deals.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the interesting ones starting off was with Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, because again, fantastic Dawn Soler, who at that time was at Columbia, and Frankie Pine, and they were working on Dead Man Walking. They had heard Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan and had got hold of us. And their idea was to get Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan to work with Eddie Vedder. So we arranged to get Nusrat, because he happened to be going to America. So we arranged to get Nusrat to attend a recording session with Eddie. And they wrote two songs together, one called The Face of Love. But what's quite interesting is Nusrat wrote all his lyrics in Urdu, and Eddie wrote them in English. And they don't speak the same languages. But at the time, we had a translator there, a guy called Rashid Ahmed Din. When Rashid translated Nusrat's lyrics, because someone had explained to him what Dead Man Walking was all about, Eddie and Nusrat had basically written the same stuff. I mean, they had powerful material, and it was from the script of Dead Man Walking, so they had powerful stuff anyway. But they addressed it in a very similar way, being compassionate and passionate, and the tracks are brilliant.
Oh my God, to be in the middle of that collaboration. Amazing, Rob. Oh my God. I mean, honestly, we could go on and on and on, but I'm just looking at the time. And yeah, Rob, we're going to have you come back and you know, fill in all the gaps. Thank you so much for your time this evening. Thank you for sharing your stories and your insights. We are going to be talking about sync deals, and I would love to have your perspective on the conversation if you could stick around.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll hang out. Thank you, everybody. I hope I didn't bore the hell out of you. Yeah, before I go, all I'm going to say to everybody is be good.
Yes. Before we move on, I should say, look, Rob, he represents artists and libraries for Sync. Rob has a weekly showcase that he promotes for up-and-coming artists. So if you're in the audience, definitely follow this man. You know, follow him on Instagram. We'll make his websites available through our channels as well. But if you're looking for advice, knowledge, guidance, possibly representation, this is the man to contact. Rob, thank you again from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hey, Edge, I was on the site today.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so cool. You know, you can listen to the podcast from there now.
Yeah, cool.
I'm loving Craig Ross's episode. Those moments with Derwood Andrews and Danny Saber.
Oh, right. The Sync Report podcast?
Yeah. What's your favorite episode, Edge?
They're all great, right?
Yeah. Thanks, Edge. You're the best. You too could be cool like Edge and listen to our podcast at twocentsmusic.com. Number two and two S's in cents. Created by Blaster Web Services.
Welcome to the Sync Report.
It's time for Sync Opportunities.
Ray Lee calling in from Malaysia.
Good morning, Jason. Yes. Thank you very much. But first of all, I would like to thank Jason. I'm honored to be chosen by you to participate in such a wonderful room. Yeah, basically, I also would like to thank all the musicians, Diana, Dylan, Wesley, Vinachi, and Derwood for submitting your music for my trailer. And you guys are awesome. I mean, I think all music is perfect.
You were having difficulty picking. It was not easy. You had a lot of good choices.
I'm asking Jason,
we need to make six different trailers. You're crazy. Your editor would have killed both of us.
I'm trying to blast the different trailer with different kind of music, but it's okay. I'll just follow you.
Look, let's start with an introduction, Ray. Tell us a little bit about you and your film. And then let's talk about the trailer that we were looking for the music.
Oh yeah, I'm Ray. Actually, I'm from Borneo, Malaysia. Basically, I'm an indigenous filmmaker, so I produced the first indigenous film in Malaysia. And the language is considered like an endangered language listed by the UNESCO or something like that. So the language is called Iban language. So my movie is about the Iban warriors versus zombies. So there's a group of terrorists like capture these indigenous peoples from the longhouse. And I don't know if you guys know longhouse or not. It's a longhouse inhabited by these indigenous people. And the terrorists are like using these indigenous people to become a guinea pig, trying to inject a vaccine and make them become zombies in order to grab the land. Yeah. So my movie going to screen in Malaysia, premiere on 28th of August, and Japan, Asia premiere in Japan.
There's English in it as well, right, Ray? It's a mixture of languages.
Yeah, the terrorists is using English. The production, actually, we shot this movie in 2019, but before the feature film started, we started in 2016 as a short film. So we used the short film to approach all the funder.
Brilliant.
And eventually we got the funds in 2018, and we took about 1 year to finish the script.
How many festivals it is?
Yeah, the next festival that we're going to secure is from Japan. So far we have like 20 film festivals from 10 countries.
Oh, so, congratulations, Ray. All right, well, let's do this. If Jess is ready, why don't we spin that selection of rays?
Yo. Thank you.
It's perfect. And what's brilliant about placement is where Medhat actually created that to the script, his track to the script. Durwood, tell us, when was the song recorded? What was the meaning behind it? And how did you realize immediately that this was the perfect song for Ray?
Well, I hoped it was because Ray said he wanted something dark. And that's one of the darkest tracks I've done. And it was released on a 12-inch, well, it was released on an album as a pop song, but we did a 12-inch remix, which is this, and it was released in 30 years ago, in 1991. Amazing. So why I wrote it and what it's about, I have no idea.
Well, it works perfect. Ray, why don't you come back and give us a couple words? Why did you pick the song? What was it about it? I mean, it's funny because really when Ray picked the track, and he struggled to pick the songs, I got to tell everyone, it was a struggle for him. But, you know, when he picked your track, Drew, he had no idea the legacy behind the name, which was beautiful. He picked the song really because it fit. So, Ray, you know, give us your thoughts.
I think this song is perfect because the title is Do No Wrong. It's something like, it portrayed the whole movie's the scenario. It's like the indigenous people do no wrong to kill everyone who were infected by the zombie pandemic. And I think from the beginning of the first second, I felt that this song is like perfect. I've been looking for this kind of, I don't know, Durwood, is this considered progressive rock or cult rock?
I have no idea, Ray. But the thing is, I've always tried to be not riding the wave, but sitting on the beach looking at it. I've always wanted to be ahead of what might be coming. So I don't think that sounds 30 years old.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Can I just thank Ray for considering my music? Thank you very much, sir.
I'm the one who thanks you, I mean, to allow me to use your music in my trailer.
So, Ray, will you be able to sync the music to the trailer and we'll be able to share that on our social media next week?
Are you going to sing it? I'm going to sing it, right? I'm going to sing it. I'm going to put the credit on my trailer. I think you have to send me the information.
Obviously, yes. We'll follow up, Derwood. Thank you so much for participating and contributing such amazing music. Really excited about this process, everybody. And of course,
Jess,
our new music supervisor, is doing a great job and, you know, is here to help support anybody in the audience, and we'll be issuing the new sync opportunities as we get to them. And my incredible co-host and producer of our podcast, Paula, thank you. Thank you so much, my friend.
Bro, thank you. Thank you.
Good night. Thank you all. Good night.
Thank you to our featured guest, Rob Bazza, for such a wonderful conversation, and indie filmmaker Ray Lee for taking part in our sync opportunity. Congratulations to Derwood Andrews and his band Westworld as the sync selection for Ray Lee's trailer. Of course, I have to thank Kevin, Milfredo, Jackie, Paula, Lisa, Jess, Jennifer, Jody, Lynn, Dr. Montgomery, Robert, Edge, and everyone on the team that makes this show run so smooth. Most of all, thank you, our audience, for listening and for submitting amazing music. Until next Thursday, take care and be kind.